welcome to an episode of No Planet B, a podcast where we're talking about climate change and its effects on planet A. I'm Wyatt, and I'm doing this one alone without Brianna because life is chaos, but we do still want to get these episodes out to y'all. So this week we interviewed Kevin Morris, who is the manager of engineering and projects at the Peace River Water Supply Authority, which is unique because that is one of the largest surface water collecting authorities where they rely only on water from a river that is completely at the mercy of the tide. So this is someone whose job is directly affected by climate change, and so we thought that was really important, and he was a really good, knowledgeable source for information, and just Florida's sweetheart. So let's dive right into that. This is one of our first episodes that we recorded, and we did it online. So sorry if our, you know, our questions were written from a little script, and our audio quality isn't the best, but it was still good information, a great interview, and I hope you all enjoy.
It's nice to be with you this afternoon, and first let me thank you for doing this podcast and for inviting me to be a part of it.
Of course.
My background, I have bachelor's and master's degrees in environmental engineering from the University of Central Florida in Orlando, and I have an MBA from Florida State University. Now, when I first graduated from school, I went to work for a consulting firm called CH2M Hill, and they're not around anymore. They were bought up by Jacobs. But I went to work right there in Gainesville, and I worked for 5 years in their Gainesville Design Center, and then I spent 5 years in their Orlando office. And the Orlando office also supported a lot of work in Puerto Rico, so I had a lot of travel, and that was exciting. But as you get a little further on in life and you're trying to start a family, all that travel is kind of stressful. So my wife and I were looking for a place to a different job for me where I didn't have to travel so much, and that's when I came to the Water Supply Authority in 1999. So it's 20 years ago this year.
Wow.
So that's a little bit about where I started and how I ended up here.
Would you mind sharing your perspective on the value that you believe the Florida Water and Climate Alliance provides to your organization and network?
The Florida Water and Climate Alliance is kind of an extension of our own capabilities. My organization is fairly small. We're a utility, and we only have 50 employees. So we don't have a lot of staff, research staff, or scientists on board. And so the Water and Climate Alliance gives us a venue where several times a year we get together with just some amazing experts in a variety of different fields. We have social scientists, we have meteorological researchers, hydrologists, agricultural engineers. We've even had PhD economists spend time with us at some of our sessions. And so it's a great opportunity to find out about the latest tools and techniques that are out there in the industry to solve some of the problems we have. Another advantage of the Florida Water and Climate Alliance is the diversity. I just talked about all those various different groups. And one of the problems that can happen if you just hang around people like yourself or the people in your company is you get groupthink. And it's a negative aspect where you all begin to think and respond to things the same way. And so having that creative input from folks from other disciplines all over the state is just really, really conducive to keeping the ideas fresh. And that's a big help. And then the last thing I would say, when you talk about the realm of climate change, which was one of the reasons that we're having this conversation today, there's a lot of negative energy in the discussion a lot of times. And this is a very positively oriented group. And it's looking to build on that positivity. And that's not always the case in groups that you can be a part of. If you've ever been part of a PTO at a school or a homeowner association, there's a lot of, unfortunately, the negative energy that sometimes comes to those meetings. But the atmosphere at the Florida Water Climate Alliance is very, it's mutual support, respect, and looking to grow capacity within that network. It's a really easy group to be a part of.
Yeah, I agree. That's so cool and so like convenient and such a supporting group. I remember I went to one of the meetings there just as an undergrad and was just so overwhelmed by how like nice and supportive everyone was.
Was that the meeting last April in Tallahassee?
It was, yeah.
Yeah, I can't believe a year has almost gone by. Time flies so fast.
Yeah. So, what is the Peace River Minnesota Regional Water Supply Authority? And are there any distinguishing factors or accomplishments which make your organization unique in what it does?
Yes. So who are we? We are a wholesale water provider. And what that means is that we only provide drinking water to four counties. So we're south of Tampa Bay by about an hour. This region is home to about a million people. Now, we only focus on potable water, but there's recognition in our industry that oftentimes drinking water is used for irrigating landscaping. And really, there are lesser quality waters that could be used for that. And so there's this concept of one water that has become embraced in the industry, and we're recognizing that, you know, reclaimed water, reuse water, storm water, there's a lot of different waters out there, but we need to really get smart and do collaborative planning to make sure that we're very intelligently designing systems to meet our water needs using all of these various different sources. Now, one of the things that makes us very unique is the fact that we are one of the largest surface water systems in the state that relies on a river that is completely at the mercy of the tide. Okay, there's no dam, there's no salinity barrier. The water that flows down the Peace River flows unobstructed to tide. And so what we have to do is harvest the water out of that river when it's available and put it in off-stream reservoirs. And here I'm going to share my screen and bring up Google Earth to kind of give you a sense for where we are in the world. Now, here's the challenge for us. We're located at sea level. And during the dry season, we actually get salt water back up as far as our intake.
Oh, okay? No.
We don't have a dam or a salinity barrier anywhere between us and Charlotte Harbor. And so that's a huge constraint that we have. And one of the reasons that we're, you asked us what makes our facility unique. Tampa Bay Water also has an off-stream reservoir that they fill from the Alafaya River, but they have other sources of supply. This is our sole source of supply. Our river intake is right on a thread off of the river, and we divert water into these reservoirs. This reservoir is a square mile. We built it 10 years ago. This reservoir is about 80 acres. Together, they hold about 6.5 billion gallons of water, which is enough for about 6 months. We have 21 aquifer storage and recovery wells. We have more aquifer storage and recovery wells at this site than any other location in the eastern United States. And what that allows us to do is to store treated drinking water underground during the wet season, and then in the dry season, we can withdraw that water back out of the ground.
Oh, cool.
So we're pushing water deep underground. It's going between 500 and 1,000 feet deep, and we're storing the water in very porous limestone. And that limestone has water in it already. Our water just pushes out and displaces the water that is there. Then when we recover our water comes back along with some mixing from the native water. Aquifer storage and recovery allows you to store immense amounts of water underground with a very small footprint above ground. We can store the same amount of water underground as you see in these reservoirs, right? So we can store 7 billion gallons underground, and we can store almost 7 billion gallons of water above ground.
My goodness.
So those are some of the aspects that makes our facility unique.
Yeah, I'd say so.
I will go back to the main camera now.
Cool.
Sounds good. Okay, so what is your current role at the Peace River Minnesota Regional Water Supply Authority, and has it changed over time?
Okay, yes. I've been here 20 years. The titles have changed. When I first came here, I was the chief engineer. Then I transitioned to the facility division director. Then I became the science and technology officer. And currently, I'm the manager of engineering and projects. And what's changed, 10 years ago probably was the first time we really started thinking about climate change. We had always considered reliability. Reliability planning is sort of a cornerstone of engineering practice. But sustainability was a new way of thinking for us. We're at the mercy of Charlotte Harbor, and we already see salt water at our intake. We're really conscious of the risk sea level rise poses to us from the standpoint of salt water coming back to our intake again. So I would say what's changed in the last 10 years, we've gotten bigger. We've built a lot of additional facilities, but the mindset kind of has changed, and there's the nuance of sustainability that has sort of worked its way into our programmatic planning activities.
That's really interesting. So you kind of have gone from just reliability to like reliability and now sustainability.
That's right. And an aspect of that we're really kind of proud of. We put together system models, and they're mass balance models that try to predict many years into the future, not only will we have enough water, but what's the water quality going to be like? Because as the water flows down the river, I can develop models that predict what kind of water quality will get out of the river. And when I say quality, what I'm talking about is the total dissolved solids, because our conventional alum coagulation facility does not remove total dissolved solids. It does a fantastic job at removing the organics, the tannins, the humic acids, the total organic carbon, but it doesn't touch the salt. As a matter of fact, we add about 75 milligrams per liter of total dissolved solids, mostly sulfate, chloride, and sodium, with the chemicals at the plant. So in the future, as salt water starts working its way back up the estuary towards our plant, we're really concerned about that. And so with our models, what we're trying to do is predict what not only will we have enough water, but what will the quality be like. And we've had opportunities to go all over the nation and present papers about our models on that capability.
So in 2015, you collaborated with NOAA to make the U.S. Climate Resilience Toolkit. Is that right?
That's right. We did. The Water and Climate Alliance did.
Oh, awesome. So with that in mind and with your expertise, would you consider Florida a resilient state in terms of climate change?
I mean, it's a really good question. It kind of depends on your perspective and the scale of the change you're anticipating. When you consider if all your perspective is drinking water, Florida is a peninsula surrounded by ocean water. Desalination is always a process that's available to us. And so we're never going to run out of water. It's certainly going to be more expensive because desalination is a very energy intensive process. But we're seeing, I'm really encouraged to see hundreds and hundreds of acres of solar fields as our local power utilities are taking advantage of renewable energy. And so they're, that will help to hold a lid on energy costs. And so so perhaps if we did have to go to desalination for water supply, the cost wouldn't escalate too much. But I think the more important discussion is not necessarily will we have water to send to the homes, but where will the homes be? The challenges in water supply pale in comparison to flooding and inundation risk for communities. We've seen sea level rising about 3 millimeters a year. And when I talk to audiences, I'll take two pennies and I will stack them on top of each other. And I say, that's about 3 millimeters. And in a decade, it's an inch or more. So can we sustain, an inch per decade between now and 2100, 8 more inches of sea level rise? Well, that's a nice slow level of rise. I think we probably could sustain that because that sort of a measured slow increase kind of gives the the real estate markets and local planners the opportunity to make adjustments without some sort of destabilizing, chaotic change. But the problem is most of the experts are projecting that, that sea level rise is actually accelerating, and that we're not going to see just 8 inches of sea level rise by 2100. We could see anywhere between 2 and 6 feet of sea level rise. I saw an article online that Zillow, the real estate tracking website, is projecting there could be up to 500,000 homes in Dade County that are underwater in 2100.
That's so nuts.
That's not slow gradual change.
That's Zillow.
That's an upheaval in your tax base. You know, where are the people going to move to? Right now, they're sandwiched between the coastline and the Everglades, and you can't back into the Everglades. So it's going to be those are going to be some real challenges for us. You know, at some point, banks are going to stop issuing 30-year mortgages because they consider it too risky. At some point, insurance companies are not going to sell flooding policies for these areas that are in these vulnerable areas. I also read another article that said that oceanfront property in the Miami-Dade area is selling at a 7. It's already, when you compare it to other nearby property over the same time span, is selling at a 7% discount. So there are already people that are concerned enough about owning property close to the water that it's starting to take a little bit of an edge off of the real estate market in Southeast Florida. So it depends on your perspective. It depends on the time scale. I think, you know, water supply, we're in pretty good shape, but I think that's only the tip of the iceberg of the problem.
And now this is a really vague question, but I'm really interested to hear your perspective on it. What can Floridians do in general to be more resilient and sustainable?
That's a really good question. I was at the German American Chamber of Commerce, came to USF about 3 months ago. So I had a chance to sit down and talk with folks just like us, but from Germany. And it's interesting, the cultural differences. In Germany, they not only recycle paper, plastic, and glass, they have their putrescible food waste that they are recycling at the end of every day. That's how conscious they are of the need to recycle and be sustainable. They also, as they were growing up, they were taught in Germany that you turn on the shower to get yourself wet, but then you turn it off while you lather yourself up, and then you turn the water on to rinse yourself off.
That's so cool.
It is, but what drives that is the fact that they pay 6 to 7 times more for their water than we do. So when your water costs that more, and your father is holding the water bill at the end of the month, you know, so my point is that it's sort of cultural and it's ingrained. I think, you know, there's a lot of value in teaching your children, because that's when you learn it. You learn so many things when you're young. And so whether you intend to or not, you're teaching your children to recycle and to be sustainable. And so what I'm asking people to do, I guess, is to make that a conscious choice to be sustainable. You know, there's many things we can do, little things. You can buy the WaterSense and Energy Star rated appliances. We can fix water leaks. We can plant Florida-friendly landscaping in our yards and use drip irrigation where we have to irrigate. You can replace the old water toilets. There's a lot of little things we can do. And there's 22 million people in the state of Florida right now. If we all do a little, then it certainly, I think, can add up and make a difference.
Yeah, that's really true. That actually reminds me. So you volunteer with high schoolers and middle schoolers, right?
I do, yes.
How do you feel about the science education? And you can relate it to climate change if you want to, but in general, like the science education that kids are getting now and how that'll relate to them being resilient in the future.
I have a child that just came. He graduates this year from the public school system in Manatee County. And he has been exposed to so much more than I remember. growing up in the 70s and the 80s and going through the public school system. So I think they're doing a fantastic job with education. But then again, my sample size is very small, unfortunately, on that.
You said he's graduating this year?
He is, yes.
Oh, congratulations. That's going to be a fun time.
We're quite proud of him.
Oh.
So what would you consider three of the greatest challenges that are facing your industry today? And how do climate change and adaptation management factor into those?
Everybody that I talk to in my industry, one of the things we're really facing is just succession planning, because my boss is 67, and one of these days he's going to step down. All around me, organizations at the county, the city level, water management districts, Department of Environmental Protection, all of these groups, they have baby boomers, and those baby boomers are starting to retire. And so what we're losing is the collective wisdom and the experience going back many decades. And so that's a real tough thing for organizations. We're all kind of struggling with it. But, interesting, ironically, a lot of times your older folks are less, they're less amenable to change. And so climate change is a little, talking about sustainability is a little tougher for them. And so there may actually be a benefit in sort of reloading with younger staff, younger professional staff that may have grown up with it and been educated about it. I know when I went to school, we did not have sustainability programs. There are now USF in Tampa offers a master's degree in sustainability. So I think, that's sort of an ironic twist. Certainly one of the big concerns in our industry is the cost of replacing deteriorating infrastructure. When you build a dam or a reservoir, a levee system, you want it to last well beyond 100 years. When you're using the standards to design it and you don't know where sea level is going to be, you begin to wonder, are we investing a lot of money in an asset to replace it in a location where it's going to be useless in 30 years? We spend about $1 billion every year in Florida on water infrastructure alone, collectively. And it is something we struggle with. I won't be here in 30 years. Somebody will be. And I just want to make sure we're making the right decisions today so that the decisions we make today and the assets we build are still the right mix of assets 30 years from now. And then I would say, kind of adding to that, the lack of consistent guidelines. If I want to design a stormwater pond, I can easily find charts for a 1 in 25 year storm, but I cannot find regulatory agencies that will dictate to me how high sea level is going to be by 2050, by 2075, by 2100. As designers in the field, we have to look through all of the various different resources rather than go to one consistent location and we all use the same standards, the same projections. We're left to sort of fend for ourselves. And I really wish that the state and the federal government would take a little stronger stand and establish some planning guidelines for us to use.
And our last question, what are some of the barriers to our ability to foster open and honest discussions about climate change? And do you have any suggestions for how others can successfully frame this discussion?
Climate change is one of those topics that people feel very strongly about. It's been heavily politicized, and oftentimes, because of the baggage that comes along with the political aspects, you're not even having a discussion about climate change. I think one of the things is really important is to just understand that everybody develops their own worldview based on what they've been taught, what they've experienced. Your belief systems that underpin this worldview, it's deeply ingrained, and every new piece of sensory information that comes in is filtered through that. You're not even aware of it. It happens subconsciously. So, a good strategy in talking with people about controversial topics, whether it's climate change or whether it's other social programs that may be controversial, is to try and find common ground. And if you can identify a commonly held beliefs and appeal to them, that brings sides together. It gives them something to find agreement on and helps them start from a point of togetherness. Like, for example, regardless of what political party you may represent, we can all usually agree on some of the framing ideas, like the value in preserving natural systems, or the value in maintaining plant and animal diversity. So based on that sort of broad framework of ideas we can agree on, we can then use those key points and just sort of branch out and explore ideas without maybe getting into a shouting match. And then people like to know how things connect. And if you can show that, like before and after pictures, one of the techniques that I use in talking to audiences is showing them just the pictures before and after of some of the glaciers to show just how glaciers have retreated. It's actually showing them that global ice masses are depleting. And so those showing them those connections really is a good technique. And then finally, you just have to have patience, because you have to build these relationships. You have to pay into them. You're not going to change people's mind overnight. And I know that coming up to the last presidential election, I looked at a Gallup poll, and the Gallup poll asked American citizens, what are your top 10 concerns or your top 15 concerns? And climate change wasn't even in the top 10. The top 10 are jobs, the economy, healthcare, education for our kids, immigration. So there's a lot of different issues that resonate higher with the general public.
Yeah, that's really interesting how you were saying that the list of the top things that are concerning people in climate change isn't even on it. I wonder if as time goes by and there's going to be more like tangible results of climate change, like sea level rise, I wonder how that list is going to change. As it becomes not a threat, but more of a reality.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And another thing is that depending on where you collect your poll data, you know, if you collect poll data in Kansas, they're not worried about sea level rise.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that's all the questions we have for you.
Mm-hmm. Well, great. I've enjoyed this.
Thank you so much, and thanks for being here and taking the time.
You're very welcome. Okay, great. Well, you guys made that very painless. That was my first podcast. And I would say I wouldn't be afraid to do another one.
Aw, that's so cool. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Okay. All right, guys. Thank you. Take care.
Yeah. Thank you. You too. Hey, I told you he was sweet, didn't I? Yeah, so great interview. And thank you all for listening this far. So yeah, if you enjoyed it, if you ever felt generous enough, leave us a little 5-star review on iTunes, because you know that's really one of the best ways we can get out there. That and word of mouth, and obviously we really believe in what we're doing, and we really want to get this information out there as much as possible, and you know, engage people in climate change conversation. So those reviews and those recommendations really do mean a lot. And you can follow us on Twitter at No Planet B Cast. And Instagram at No Planet B FSU. And tell your neighbor about climate change, and have a good, enjoy, go treat yourself to some nitro cold brew. If you drink it, if you don't, do not do it. No one's making you. It's not cool. Hey, but if you do, hey, cool Wyatt here. Treat yourself to some nitro cold brew. You know, consider it Wyatt on this end, but if you don't want the caffeine, I understand, don't do that. But cool Wyatt does say treat yourself to nitro cold brew. I'm not really sure what kind of bit I'm doing here, but yeah, thank you for listening, and we'll see you on the internet.